So does anyone have any questions from last week or from the practice instruction last week? Or anybody want to report how it's going? Or? Yes?
Last time I was, sort of helped me work through focus. So focus was something I could modulate. And I found that that really helped a lot.
Great.
Felt like I wanted to high five someone. and then I felt kind of bad about, oh man, you shouldn't feel like you want to high five someone about this. So I guess what I wanted to ask was first is, like, hey, thanks, that really helped me take a step. And then, so you've got to give up really humility along the way somehow, or do you understand my question?
I'm not sure, but let me try this.
My question is, so there's this concept of progressing.
Yeah.
And, how do you...
Is it okay to feel good about progressing?
Yeah. And I'm not holding my hands and expect you to cane me or anything, but I think just maybe more broadly, sort of, how do you think and motivate...
Well, the issue of progress in meditation practice is a little bit complex and delicate issue. There is progress that can be made in terms of developing concentration, developing stillness, developing calm, developing compassion, developing our capacity for peace, developing our capacity for insight. There's a lot of things that can be developed over time with practice. And then the question is, how do we relate to that? Some of that kind of progress and development is very healthy and very worthwhile, very wholesome. And it's fine to feel good about it, feel happy. Be happy about that and feel good about it. And it's happy. There's also a healthy way to have that motivate you and feel inspired by it. Oh, this is a possibility and I can go for that. And there's also a lot of unhealthy ways to relate to progress. And for example, a person can be striving too much or demanding or then measuring how far they've gotten or they're comparing themselves to the people, their neighbors. You know, how far has my neighbor gotten in meditation? And I haven't gotten as far as they are, or the people got to look how far I've gotten. I'm just like the best meditator on the block, and everybody in the block, thinks you're just a nuisance because you're going around showing off. And so the problems of conceit, problems of discouragement, all kinds of problems. And one of the problems of excitement, like if you want to high five someone, is that as meditation gets more and more subtle, as you get deeper and deeper levels of peace and concentration, the meditation becomes more fragile. In a sense, to subtle ripples, because the quieter the lake is, the surface of the lake, the more a little bit of movement in the lake surface will cause a ripple. If it's a big tempestuous storm and you put your finger into the lake, you won't notice that you're doing anything. So as the mind gets quieter and quieter, there can be very deep states of meditation that occur. And then if a person in the meditation session gets excited, wow, that's great, they'll pop right out of that state. So you have to be careful not to get caught up in the reactions to the state while it's happening. Does that make sense? Is this at all helpful to what you're talking about? So stay. Mostly try to stay. Continuous with the practice. Don't get excited about what happens in practice while you're practicing. But after you've come out of meditation, if you want to, be a little bit excited and happy, and tell your best friend, hey, you can't believe what happened to me today. It's okay. Yes, please.
I took the bus here, and I'm looking for a ride home from someone who would be going along El Camino a little bit near the Atherton-Redwood City border. It's about a mile south of the side. Is anybody going that way? Would you be willing to offer a ride?
Sure.
Thank you. I also just wondered about use of timer. I haven't found time to do very long meditation, so I tell myself, well, at least do 10 or 15 minutes. But it seems when I do a short meditation like that, I'm always thinking, okay, well, it's going to be or anything. just do a little longer. And it seems like I'm thinking about
the end.
Uh-huh. If you had any, is it better just to maybe do a longer meditation because it's harder to have that attitude? Or?
Maybe, maybe not. Ajahn Sumedho, who was a famous monk teacher, meditation teacher, said once, if the length of time was important, chickens would be enlightened. Because they, you know, the length of time of sitting, if you're just sitting, you know, because they just sit around a lot. And so it isn't just a matter of how long you sit. It's a matter of the quality of that sitting. And so you can have very high quality sitting in 10 minutes if that's all you can do. If you can do more and it suits, you know, what's going on with you and your inner life, I think it's better to sit longer. But if that's all you can do, it's better to sit than not to sit at all. And if you have some kind of something difficult like that arises, any difficulty that arises in meditation is considered part of the process to work through and to bring attention to. So rather than thinking that, oh, I can't do meditation because I'm so looking forward to the end and anxious about the end or whatever, turn your attention and look at that anxiety or that impatience or that concern and bring that into the field of the meditation. And with familiarity, as you see it more clearly, as you're honest about it, and as you really kind of acknowledge it fully, I think that its grip on you will slowly fade away. And after a while, you know, you might arise, but, oh, there's my old friend, impatience, and it won't get in the way. It'll just be like a pesky fly in the background. So I would just hang in there and just be patient with the process and include what's happening to you as part of the practice rather than as an interruption to the practice. Generally, in the kind of mindfulness meditation that we do, it's best to consider everything that occurs as fuel for the meditation practice, as included within the meditative process, as opposed to setting up a distinction between that which is acceptable for meditation and that which is unacceptable, that which shouldn't be happening. And as soon as you have something which shouldn't be happening as part of the meditation, then you're going to set a wall, and that wall is going to cause you to suffer. So one of the beautiful things about this practice is that everything's included. It's very all-inclusive. And so that's one of the things we're learning as we go through this, is how to include things. And I like to think of it, in Buddhism at least, that the most sacred thing in Buddhism is that awareness, that consciousness, which is all-inclusive. And that we lose touch of the sacred realm when awareness or consciousness in some ways divides our experience between that which is acceptable and not acceptable, that which we think we can pay, you know, we should pay attention to, and that which we shouldn't pay attention to. It's the all-inclusive nature of awareness we're developing, and that's where the ultimate freedom and peace can be found. So we train ourselves to pay attention to whatever arises. Yes?
What track not to take?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because you can stop yourself.
Yes.
And I'm trying to recall what you said and what I've read in your papers. And if we focus on the breath and then try to watch the scenery around, while you keep, it's like driving on the highway, but you're still watching more than what's in front of us.
Right.
Knowing always that we have to stay on the freeway. And it's all fine and dandy until like thought comes by. The distractions are supposed to be not be an issue in mindfulness meditation.
But
I think distractions are different. They have different intensities.
Yes.
With a motorbike, you know, there's someone around the neighborhood runs for a motorbike. I mean, that just wavers you for a little while, but you know for sure that's going to go away in a few seconds and it goes away. But a thought's a little more intense. And if we don't stop it in time, it takes the next level of trying to prove its importance and then trying to think about it. And that's where I get caught. I did come in and read today's stuff, and it answers a lot of the questions. At least it gives me ways of trying to recognize it, accept it, and stuff like that. But I still feel it's not... Oh, the handout, is that correct?
This is the third week handout?
Yes.
This third week on it?
So I still feel it's kind of difficult to definitely pull away from the thought, and I actually as to whether I can try and not resolve the thought, but understand the thought, not to try and get rid of the, not
not to try and find a solution,
right,
but in order to respond less reactively,
uh-huh,
and then move on to the next.
That's a very good question, and next week we'll talk more about thoughts, how to handle it, but so I'll only say a few things now. The there are various strategies by which Buddhist practice is done, and mindfulness is one of those strategies. The relation, but when we do mindfulness practice itself, then it isn't that we think of thoughts aren't a distraction unless we're distracted by them, unless we're lost in them. But we don't assume that thoughts are distracting. They can be the subject of mindfulness. You can see and acknowledge and observe the thinking process itself. And that's what mindfulness is, that observing capacity. See, this is what's going on. And in the observation, not being caught by what's happening. The thought process might continue, but you find yourself more and more independent from that. And if you do that, then usually it tends to fade away by itself. Occasionally, as if thoughts persist over time, then you want to bring that mindfulness to be more cognizant, more discerning about what this experience of thinking is for you. And then you might notice other aspects of the thinking experience besides the content of the thoughts. And you might notice, for example, the emotion that might be the fuel for it, the foundation for those kinds of thoughts being there. So if you have a very compelling kind of thought, thinking over and over again, planning is a classic one. If a person's planning all the time, most people who spend a lot of time planning in meditation have a level of fear, apprehension, anxiety, worry that's underlying that kind of thinking. And so what you do then is you ground your attention in the worry. Not so much to stop having the thoughts, but to learn how to pay attention carefully to what's happening in the present moment. As you do that, the tendency is that those worrying feelings won't continue making planning thoughts. There's no need to anymore because you're attending to what's more primary. So you have to be a little bit careful around thoughts when you do mindfulness practice and not think that you're supposed to necessarily stop them. Though it can be very wise. So if you can, in an easy way, let go of them. By all means, let go of them. If it's relatively easy to let go of a certain track of thought, which is not useful to be on, let go of it. But if it's not easy to let go of, then the instructions are either let it be in the background, don't be bothered by it, or let it be the subject of meditation itself. And we'll talk more about that next week. Is this addressed a little bit your concern?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm beginning to see that. I'm beginning to see that it gets nowhere. And
yeah.
I relax. There's a less of a sense of self, I, and an attachment to it, which really reduces a lot of the attention.
Great. Lovely.
But it's kind of recurring.
Kind of what?
It recurs. And I'm trying to figure out how to find a happy balance between the mind and body, because that's what... paying attention to the body is not that easy for me. I'm trying to find tools where I can recognize the presence of the body while it's working.
Great.
More than because I'm always here.
So what you might do is take a period of time, a few months, and just emphasize mindfulness of the body and really cultivate it strongly. Make it that primary meditation that you do, just mindfulness of the body. We can talk more about it later. But what do you think about thoughts and sense of self? Who are you when you're not telling your thoughts about? If your thoughts are not telling you who you are, who are you? Possession?
Yeah.
Possession.
That's what I think.
Your possession? Your possessive nature is who you are?
No. If my thoughts are not who I am, then it must be, you know, my clothes and stuff I have in my house.
Oh, that way. But you have to have a thought in order to have that idea. But the idea of possessions happens through the medium of thoughts. What happens to your possessions if you don't have any thoughts about them? Do you possess them then? Yeah.
That's actually been very disconcerting to me over the last few months as I've, in meditation, begun to let go of some of these things that I've kind of held on to, the recurring thoughts, and there's a deep sense of emptiness and just real grief at the things that thought were me that aren't.
Great.
Yeah. So kind of whatever reaction when you see that. But the question I have is this week I was meditating, I got lost in thought, and some unpleasantry of it, you know, awakened me. And I thought, oh, I got lost in thought. And then I said, now what was I thinking about? And I wanted to go back to my original thinking distraction, not back to meditating. I wanted to find the original kind of pleasant thought before I got all distracted. One of the things that I've found, and you gave some instruction and have over time, and how to really kind of get ourselves centered into the intention of meditating. One of the things that I have a hard time with during my meditation sessions is actually, I can bring myself back really, really gently, but I have a hard time bringing myself back fully to the point where I'm actually back in the breath. I have a hard time maintaining that intention through the whole time sometimes, and really almost as if I'm, I don't know if it's just, do I need to feel like I'm starting all over again, like I'm reseeing, you know, I have our time re-entering back with that original intention of sitting down in my chair to meditate.
So in the middle of a sitting, if you get distracted by thoughts, lost in thoughts, and then to come back fully to the breath again, or connect again, there's a kind of reluctance or hesitation to really kind of come back and fully.
Yeah, and I've worked a lot at being gentle with myself, kind of cajoling, okay, now take a breath, you know, whatever. And that's actually helped somewhat. But the true kind of letting go, it's almost like I get in kind of a little bit externalized state from that and then have a hard time.
Yeah, great. I have a couple of things to say. One is, don't be so idealistic about, you know, about having some wonderful, perfect way of coming back and connecting again. Just be content with that. You know that you're not connecting that well. You're not coming back very well. It doesn't. It's not very hot. It's only, you know, 20% of what you could do, and that's the way it is. And just let the practice evolve with that kind of effort, and not make a big problem out of it.
Yeah.
That probably making a problem out of it just makes it even harder. That's one thing. Do the practice with what you have. The other is rather than fixing the problem that you're describing, pay more attention to what's going on for you with your intentions, with your emotions, your feelings, your thoughts. What does it feel like? What's actually happening in the present moment when you're a little bit hesitant and you're holding back and not really ready to kind of plunge back into your present moment experience? Mm-hmm. And so rather than seeing it as a problem, seeing it as something else to pay attention to and learn about. Bring mindfulness to that. Because otherwise you set up an opposition between how what's actually happening with you and what you think is supposed to be happening with you.
Yeah.
And if there's a gap between the ideal and the actual, in Buddhism we always choose the actual to pay attention to bring our attention to. So hopefully that's helpful. So let's do a little sitting. So take an upright, alert posture. And gently close your eyes. And then take a few moments just to check in with yourself as you are right now. Checking in with your actual lived experience of body, mind, heart, how you're feeling now, how you are, what's going on, as a way of beginning to remind yourself that during the session of meditation, you're going to be here now with yourself and your experience. And it can be helpful in the beginning of meditation to take a period of time to have deep, long, slow breaths. And perhaps as you breathe in deeply, to let your belly be relaxed and expansive. Kind of let it expand outward as you breathe in. Filling your belly and your chest as you breathe in. And then as you exhale, to let go, relax. Let go with the exhalation. Let go into your weight, to gravity. It helps you settle. Settle into your body. And then letting your breath return to normal. There's no particular way you need to breathe, just the easiest way that's available. And then continuing a little bit, checking in with yourself and scanning through your body for any obvious places you can relax your muscles or soften them. It's often helpful to begin in the head and work your way down. Forehead and eyes. Letting the eyes rest in the sockets. The muscles of the face and the jaws. As you exhale, it can be helpful to relax your shoulders, soften them. Even if they don't relax, as you exhale, just the intention of letting them soften, be accepted as they are, can be helpful. It can be helpful to soften your belly. And then within your body, as part of your body, becoming aware of your breathing. Not so much, perhaps, of bringing your mind to the breath as it is letting the experience of breathing, the way the body experiences the breath, the breathing, letting that come to awareness. A very simple process of the body breathing. Becoming interested in how the breathing process affects your body. What parts move, what parts expand, contract. Feeling the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. If you notice yourself carried away by your thoughts or your commentary, if it's easy enough, let go of it and begin again with your breathing. Let the breath return to you. It might be helpful to very quietly in the mind to name the in-breath and out-breath, in, out, or rising, falling, just as a gentle, soft nudge to encourage you to stay continuously with the rhythm of the breath, to hang in there with the breathing. If you experience the release or the letting go that happens with the exhalation, you might use that as a time to let go of any thoughts that have arisen, any thinking. As you let go with the exhalation, let go of thoughts so you can be more fully with the breath. As you're staying with your breathing best you can, there's an art in holding the attention somewhat steady with the breathing, steadying the attention on the breath, but doing so in a soft way, not in a rigid or hard way or forced way. So there's a steadiness, a stability of continuity. Breathing in and breathing out. If you find yourself tired, then you might want to emphasize a little bit the inhalation. You can just feel the rising energy of breathing in, the energizing or activating aspect of breathing in. Or you might even breathe a little bit deeper as you breathe in. It might help when you're sleepy. If you're agitated in some way, then you might want to emphasize a little bit more the exhalation, resting with the out-breath, letting go with it, being calmed by the out-breath. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to shift your attention from the breath to something else. And as you shift your attention, as you let go of the breath and pay attention to this new thing, see if you can do it kind of softly or gently. Kind of more like you're softly pulling open the curtains so you can let the sunlight come in to be aware. So what I'd like you to pay attention to now instead of the breath is how you're feeling emotionally. What's the mood or the state of mind that's present for you? Are you calm or impatient? Are you sad or happy? Irritated or delighted? Anxious? Or contented? Is there some mood or mental state or emotional state that's present? And if you can find one, find what it is, then very softly acknowledge its presence. Acknowledge that it's here. See if you can allow it to be here, kind of an accepting attitude. Give it permission to be here, whatever it might be. Feel it, sense it. And then explore a little bit in your body. What are the sensations in your body that are manifesting or showing you that you have this mood or mental state or emotion? Is there some physical correlate? And if there is, bring your attention to that physical aspect of the emotion. In the best of your ability, rest in the physical aspect of the emotion, how it feels like, whether it's in your head or in your heart or in your torso, your face, hands. And as you stay present, as you give a kind of presence to your mood or emotional state, see if you can track what happens to that emotional state, the mood or mental state. Does it get stronger or weaker? Does it get bigger or smaller? It doesn't matter what happens to it. What matters for the practice is you simply notice how it changes. If the emotion you have goes away as you're watching it, then see what replaces it, what mood or emotional state replaces it or is there otherwise. And then letting go of that, of the emotional state that you have, however subtle it might be or gross. Come back for another minute or so with your breathing. And see how completely and thoroughly you can let your awareness encompass or enter into or be present for each and every in-breath and out-breath for the next minute. Not letting the mind waver into any thoughts. If you have a flashlight and you go in the dark and you shine the light of the flashlight, the light will illuminate whatever it's pointed at. It doesn't really, the light itself doesn't care what it's looking at. It just will illuminate everything. The dog poop that's on the ground, if that's what it is, or you know, the beautiful artwork on the wall, if you're illuminating that, you know, just. It just, you know, shows, shines in anything. And you can, you know, as you're moving around a room or in the dark, you can move the flashlight and the light, shine the light at different things at different times. And it helps you see clearly what's there. The awareness, our mindfulness, is kind of like sometimes likened to a flashlight. And we can bring that flashlight to bear to look at all kinds of things in our immediate experience. Awareness can't notice things happening in the past or in the future, except through the medium of our thoughts and ideas about it. But the subject of awareness is what's happening in the present moment. So the flashlight of awareness, we're training the flashlight awareness to make it a useful light that can actually see clearly the experiences of our life. So we can illuminate it, become clear about it, and learn how to relate to it in a wise way, with equanimity, with peace, not to be caught by things. If the flashlight gets caught by something, it doesn't want to leave. It doesn't become a useful light anymore. It has to be ready to be, you know, to move around and pay attention to the next things. If we keep our awareness fixated on something, then it's not so useful to open up to how things unfold and move in daily life as we go along. But what happens is awareness often gets, if it gets fixated, or attention, or our minds, on all kinds of preoccupations and concerns. And one of the things we tend to notice in meditation is how the mind gets caught and fixated. It's caught by its fantasies or its desires or its thoughts, or caught by certain sensations in the body, or it's caught by certain feelings and emotions. We're caught by the emotion, we're feeling kind of bad. We're caught by that, we have fixated on it, we assign meaning to it, or we feel bad about it, embarrassed that it's there, or we try fixated, try to manipulate, try to get rid of it, or try to hold on to it. In some way, we're doing something. What we're trying to do in mindfulness is very simply let the light of awareness shine on what's going on. And so that light itself becomes a more and more useful instrument. So the light of awareness itself becomes an independent presence, a peaceful presence that you can carry around with you in any situation at all, with any experience that you have. Now, most of us, if we have a flashlight, we're focusing not on the light itself, but we're focusing on what the light is illuminating, which makes some sense. If you're walking in the dark, you want to see the steps there and, you know, notice them. But we tend to focus on what the light illuminates. The same thing with awareness. We tend to focus on what awareness is aware of. But one of the things we're trying to develop, and we get fixated on that. So most people spend all their lives fixating on the object of awareness, the things of what you can be aware of. What else is there after all, right? That's our life. What else there is there's awareness itself, that flashlight, that light. And as that light gets developed, it becomes a stronger kind of presence within us or for us. We're kind of in a sense of being independent of the things of the world that we experience. Not independent in the sense of being aloof from or detached from. Actually, with this kind of independence, you actually feel much more intimately and lively, vitally, kind of the life that we live. But at the same time, a sense of being kind of independent of it, not caught by it, not entangled by it, free of it. So what we're trying to do with developing mindfulness is not only see clearly what our experience is, investigate, be present for it, but we're also trying to develop that independent flashlight, the awareness itself, that can be developed independent of what it pays attention to. It doesn't really matter what it pays attention to. Like if you want to sharpen a knife on a whetstone, it doesn't really matter which whetstone you're sharpening it on. You can sharpen on one for a while and then go to another and sharpen it. And whatever. To sharpen your awareness, to sharpen this independent presence of mindfulness, it doesn't matter if you're sharpening it on the breath or if you're sharpening it on your body sensations or your thoughts or your emotions or sounds. It's quite, you know, equal opportunity, you know, employer. You know, it's happy to take anything. We tend to fixate so much on the things. We want to fix things, make it better, make the headache go away, hold on to this period of joy we have, or kind of fixating on our stress and make it go away or whatever. And we're focusing on the objects. And that's fine to do often enough, but I want to emphasize that part of the great opportunity with mindfulness is not be so concerned about what, I would say it differently, is to remember that what we're trying to do is to find that place where awareness is free and independent of what it's aware of. Does that make any sense? Because probably most of you have a very good experience, lots of experience of not being free of what's going on, but being acting in a compulsive way. I have to get rid of this, I have to hold on to this, I need to have this happen, or whatever. So it becomes kind of a silent or peaceful or still or equanimous or kind of sense of presence that is somehow independent of the world that we often caught by. The Buddha gave a beautiful analogy, a simile, of he asked once to his disciples, he said, if a person is struck by an arrow, does that person hurt? Oh yeah, it's very painful for that person. And if someone comes along and hits that person with a second arrow, is that even more painful? Oh yeah, that's even more painful to be struck by two. And then to paraphrase the Buddha, then he said, the first arrow in life, you might not have any control over. The second arrow is your own doing. And what he meant by that is that, to take a very pedestrian kind of example, if you stub your toe on the sidewalk and the toe hurts, that's the first arrow. You've been hurt. Reality's kind of interfered with your walking and you're hurt for whatever reason. And then if you then say, oh, shoot, boy, am I a lousy walker. I'm probably the worst walker that ever walked on the face of the earth, and this is absolutely the worst, and I'm a terrible person because I can't even walk properly. You've added at least one more arrow, if not more. And you've added more suffering, more pain to that experience of self-criticism, of hate, of anger, of fear, of despair, of discouragement, all kinds of things that we add on. The sad thing is that many of us don't stop at the second arrow. So we stub our toe, and then we say, oh, what a terrible walker I am. I'm so embarrassed. I'll never walk in front of people again. And then we get this. Then because we feel this criticism and anger towards ourselves, then we feel so discouraged. Here I am, angry at myself. So again, it's just hopeless. And then we notice we're feeling hopeless and say, well, you know, I might as well kind of, I feel so hopeless, and you know, and so I think what I'll do is go to Baskin and Robbins and get 32 scoops of one cone, right? And that'll really make me feel better. So we compensate for that feeling. And then pretty soon we feel even more terrible with that, because we feel just so bloated, and, you know. And then we feel just, you know, so sad, you know. And then we kind of feel, oh, life is so difficult, and I never get a fair chance, and everybody else gets fair chances. And why is it that I suffer so much, you know? And you don't realize it's because you had all this ice cream, you know, that you decided to buy. But you might as well blame someone else, because that's a wonderful strategy we have for avoiding being honest. So we start blaming other people. And so we add arrow after arrow after arrow, when what the simplest thing would have been to say, oh, I stubbed my toe, it hurts. That's not, you know, and leave it at that. This is why Buddhists sometimes say that suffering is optional. And what they mean by that is that reactivity, that reactive way in which we add suffering on top of what's already happening, that's our doing. And that is our, you know, is optional. But it's only optional if you have the clear awareness and presence of mind to see where the choice is. And that's one of the reasons why Buddhists develop mindfulness and calm and concentration, to be still, so that you can notice that point of choice. If you're walking down the street and you notice an ice cream store, and the next thing you notice is you're walking down the street holding an ice cream cone, there's been lapse of attention. And then you probably haven't noticed the moment of choice. We decided to go in to buy the ice cream. And that analogy works in a lot of places in life. You know, you probably wish that sometimes you were a little bit more aware of that moment of choice before you said certain things to some people you know. And even though they deserved it, you know, you regret afterwards, you know, the problems that arose. Because, you know, you understand what I'm trying to say. So you can see that moment of choice, then you can see, oh, I can not add the second arrow. This is very important in relationship to our own emotions. And for some people aren't very aware of their emotions. Some people are hyper aware of their emotions. And some people, all people to some degree, will have, you know, acceptable emotions, unacceptable emotions. They'll have some way in which they react to their emotional life that sometimes adds second, third arrows, so adds more suffering to what's going on. A very simple example would be grief over someone's death. It's very common that people will come and say, you know, so-and-so, my husband or wife died, and I've been grieving now for 6 months or 8 months or 9 months or a year, and it's been very difficult for me. But what's the most difficult is that my friends are telling me, shouldn't you be over it by now? And so they have some idea that something that's their grief is unacceptable, something wrong about themselves having it. And then they kind of feel maybe some self-hate, because, oh, something's wrong with me. I should, you know, that I should have this, something wrong with my grief. And so suddenly the grief has become complicated by a reaction to it. Anger is another one. We feel angry, and then we feel, oh, I'm not supposed to feel angry. I was taught to be a good person, and good people don't get angry, and therefore I hate my anger. I'm going to push it away. Or we feel sad or lonely, and it makes us, feels very uncomfortable and makes us afraid to feel sad and lonely. And so the fear itself, then we get this into reactive push-pull relationship with the sadness, and we're afraid to go in there, we're afraid to be with it, we're afraid of it arising in the future, and we're afraid of fear. And so there's all these, you know, ways in which can we complicate our emotional life. What we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is, in relationship to emotions, is have uncomplicated emotions. Just allow them to be there without any further arrows. Of course, you'll have further arrows. You'll have reactions to it. And then, you know, you just add one more arrow to it, the whole process. If you said, oh, Gil said just leave it at the first arrow, and I add the second arrow, and boy, am I a klutz. You know, you just did, you know, at least another arrow, right? So that doesn't work. So isn't that nice? You know, so it doesn't work. You can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to kind of beat yourself up or feel critical at not doing it right. You're just then supposed to be mindful, oh, I didn't do it. And actually, probably if you're honest enough, you'll you'll wake up and notice, I'm at the 32nd arrow. and then you don't want to say, oh, shoot, not again. That's the 33rd arrow. What you want to do is wherever you wake up, be content there. Oh, 32nd arrow. And just let that be there. Is it making sense to you? So you wake up where you're at. Don't kind of chase after some mythic idea of, you know, where it all began. Someday, your mindfulness will be strong enough, you'll catch it at the beginning of the process. And just leave it there. It'd be great. But until that point, be content just to wake up where in the process you actually are. Another way of saying this, part of mindfulness practice is to be very self-accepting of where you're at in any given moment. Not to fight yourself or be at war with yourself or feel something's wrong with how you are. But in saying that, in relationship to emotions, you have to be very careful that you don't use that as a way of condoning or supporting or getting into the emotion even more. Oh, I'm supposed to accept the emotion, allow it to be there, and therefore I'm having this really good bout of anger, and I think I'll just go with it. And we fuel it and feed it. The middle way in Buddhism with emotions is we don't want to not feed the emotion by acting in, by engaging in it, in a sense, but also not avoiding it and repressing it. So allowing it to be there, bubble up in its own way, whatever way it wants to be there. So, for example, you're sitting here and you feel irritation. Say you just before you came here, your neighbor's dog barked a lot, and you feel irritated. So one approach to that would be, you know, I came to this Buddhist meditation center, and Buddhists are not supposed to be irritated kind of people, so I think I'll just, you know, pretend it's not there and, you know, ignore it and ignore the fact that, you know, and try to just suppress it. Another approach is to say, well, what's wrong with being irritated with my neighbor? You know, I'm going to spend this next 45-minute meditation session thinking about what I'm going to say to my neighbor when I get back home. And, you know, just, you know, and that's kind of feeding it. That's kind of getting into it. The middle way is simply to be aware that you're irritated, feel the anger, feel it's okay to be irritated, but don't do anything more with it. Don't pick it up. Don't get engaged with it. And one of the ways to do that is just to feel it in your body, to feel the immediacy of it. This is a present moment experience. And to separate the emotion from the content or the subject that's stimulating the emotion. I don't know if that made sense. But so, say that you're angry with someone. What we do is we stop focusing on the person we're angry with. We turn the attention around and pay attention, be present for anger within us. If we have strong desire, we turn away from the object of desire and pay attention to what's actually happening with us, the desiring. So if you stay connected with the subject, the thing that we're focused on and the light is focusing on, you're probably fueling it more. You stay with the stories, you're fueling it. But if you turn away and turn around and feel, what is it like just to be angry? Or to be desirous, or to feel lonely, in and of itself, without the storyline. It's a lot easier to hold it, and the emotion will probably process itself in its own healthy way. It'll heal itself, in a sense. Probably most of you know that the word emotion comes from the Latin word that has the word motion in it. E in Latin means out. Motion means motion. It means to move out. All emotions are in process. They want to move. They want to circulate. They're not fixed things. They're not frozen unless we freeze them. And how do we freeze emotions? What are frozen emotions? Resentment is frozen anger. Bad grief is frozen. You know, it's good grief, someone said. Good grief. You know, we ever thought what that means? There is good grief. And then there's bad grief. In a sense, we get frozen. We get locked on to that. And by bringing... And often we get locked and frozen when we get caught up in the storyline in some way or other. But if you can turn back and just to the emotion as it actually is in the body, the physical, emotional manifestation of the emotion, independent of the story, what you'll probably find is the emotion wants to move. It'll unfold, it'll thaw, it'll relax, it'll dissipate, it'll transform into something else. If we get out of the way of our emotions by just looking at it, being present for it, but not getting entangled with it, tendency is that it'll do whatever process it needs to do. All emotions are processes unless we interrupt the process. Does that make sense? So in mindfulness meditation, we put a lot of emphasis on being with the breath. And the breath is for most people, a very, very good ally and friend. Very helpful in this process of bringing stability in the mind and the heart, bringing mindfulness and waking up. But when you feel something, other experiences more compelling than the breath, like a physical sensation, like we talked about last week, then you want to bring your meditative awareness to that physical sensation and be present for it. If there's an emotional experience which is more compelling than your breath, rather than struggling with the breath and having a strong bout of emotions or whatever, you can just let go of the breath entirely and let the meditation be the subject, let the emotion be the subject of meditation. So how do you do that? First of all, you have to be very clear that whatever story you have connected with the emotion is not helpful for the meditative process. That doesn't mean that paying attention to the storyline isn't helpful in other contexts outside of meditation. It might be and it might not be. But for the meditative process, it's actually much more healing and more helpful to simply put aside the storyline related to it. Generally, that has to do with the past or some fantasy of the future. And just be with what's happening for you in the present. Actually, what's happening for you in the present. It's fascinating to discover how much of our emotional life is tied up with things that happen in the past and things that we think are going to happen in the future. They're not happening with anything having nothing to do with what's happening in the present moment. So we try to come back to the present moment, to our actual experience. It's very important in the meditative process to be very accepting of an emotion that arises. I like to emphasize that when you, in meditation at least, that you have unconditional permission to have any emotion at all. Isn't that freeing? For those of you who felt like some emotions are acceptable and some are not, I'm not supposed to be some way, or, you know, any emotion, you can kind of open the flood doors of your emotions. You can get out of the way of them. You don't have to censor them. You don't have to stop them. You don't have to, you know, fight with them. Just relax and let them come. And since you're in meditation, you're sitting still, and you're kind of committed to sitting still, basically. You're not acting them out. You're not going to punch someone out. You're not going to say something, you know, terrible. So it's a safe place to let these things move through you. So part of being with emotions in meditation is to be very accepting of them. Allow them to be there. It's so helpful, that process of acceptance. The second aspect is to be very, to acknowledge very clearly what the emotion is. You don't have to do a lot of thinking about it, analyzing what it is, but to have a very clear acknowledgement. Oh, this is happiness. This is fear. This is anger. To acknowledge clearly what it is. Not to kind of wash over it or kind of push it aside or kind of have a vague sense of what it is, but very kind of like you're looking at it right, you know, head on. This is fear. I gave a talk on Monday on fear. If some of you are interested in a whole talk on fear, how to work with an emotion. But it's so invaluable to have this very clear naming. And it can be actually a naming in your mind, like a labeling. Fear, fear. Joy, joy. Whatever it might be. There's a, you know, ancient kind of fairy tale or kind of folklore that if you name the dragon loses its power. And it kind of speaks to this. Sometimes we clearly name the inner dragons. They lose their power. Because part of what happens when you name something clearly in the mind, when you clearly acknowledge its presence, the observing part of the psyche that's independent from what's being observed is being activated. So that part of us which is not entangled with experience, not identified, not caught up in it, is being strengthened. And so that can be very helpful, to find this independent presence that we can have. And the more independent presence you can have with an emotion, the safer it can feel to let the emotion flow. If you're really entangled with the emotion, identified with it, and use the emotion as a way of defining yourself and representing yourself and how you're not supposed to represent yourself and all this complicated shoulds and shouldn'ts around emotions, when you're entangled with it, we suffer a lot. The other thing to do with emotions is to feel it in your body. All emotions will have some physical manifestation. In fact, if it didn't, wasn't some kind of physical manifestation for an emotion, you probably wouldn't know you're having the emotion, you know, what it was. So, you know, there can be tightening in the belly, or lifting or tightening of the shoulders, or tightening of the chest, or relaxing of different places in your body, or heat, or coldness in your body, or all kinds of different ways in which it, you know, vibration, energy, pulsing, all kinds of different sensations that go on in the body. The body is never a story. So one way to help us to extract ourselves from the storyline of the emotion is to drop down and feel it in the body. Just feel it very simply, matter-of-factly, mindfulness of the body around the emotion. A friend of mine who sat a three-month retreat once said that he was a person who very easily was afraid. Very debilitating fear in his life. And sometimes he would lock himself in his room for days at a time because he was so afraid. So this is a guy who had a lot of fear. And in the course of the retreat, the fear kicked in. And for several days, it was very hard for him. Until one day, it dawned on him that fear was a lot of tightness and contraction in his chest. And so then he grounded his attention in the chest area, feeling the contractions. And then it became the fear became manageable for him. He was able to be present for it and not be swept away by it or afraid of his fear or reactive to his fear. He just rested in the body. Let the body be the container. Let the body, in a sense, hold the emotion by feeling the emotion as it manifests in the body. As you do that, the body is the vehicle through which the emotions tend to unravel or move or process. So the more we feel the emotion in the body, probably you'll find the more the emotion is freer to do what it needs to do, to move through and process. An example of this is a friend of mine who had a lot of deaths in her life in 1 year. Her brother, her father, her best friend, and all kinds of people died in a very short time. She had a lot of grief. And she described how in daily life, the grief would come on in waves. And they would last sometimes for a long time, like an hour, a couple hours. These big waves of grief would come. And it was very painful. And then she went on a 10-day meditation retreat. And she said, oh, the grief was different there. I still had the grief. But and it was more intense on the retreat, actually, she said. But it only lasted for a minute or two. These waves would come, and they would just last for a couple minutes and would pass away. And what was happening on the retreat was she wasn't distracted by all the activities of daily life that keep us kind of distracted, so we're not really present for what's going on. And she wasn't so reactive to what was going on. She wasn't trying to avoid it or hide it or say later or this is not the right time or, you know, I don't know, all kinds of things that we kind of do. She'd learned in meditation to just give it permission to be there, be fully present for it, fully acknowledge it, let it flow through her body, surf with it, kind of let it move through. And when you did that, the waves actually didn't last very long. They moved through very quickly. So the tremendous value of kind of non-reactive presence, just allowing things to be. So there can also be great joyful emotions that happen in meditation. Great experience of joy and delight can happen, bliss. The process is the same thing with that, is to then bring attention to that, name it, see it, accept it, give it permission to be there, but be very careful that if you're accepting your bliss, you aren't in some way leaning into it, that finally, this is great. I can't wait till I show my neighbor, you know, or, you know, somehow, oh, this validates how great I am. You know, I must be the next Mother Teresa. You know, we get entangled so easily. And when it's a really pleasant emotion or pleasant sensation in meditation, we're seduced by that we don't notice how we're getting entangled. If it's an unpleasant emotion, it's so painful to be entangled, we're often motivated to kind of be free of it. To let the meditative process unfold and deepen in its own way, it's very important to have this equanimous attitude to both the wonderful things that happen and to the difficult things that happen. Treat them all equally. Be an equal opportunity employer. You know, just pay attention to this, what's happening now. Let's bring attention to it. Let's feel. Let's bring presence to it. Let's see how not to be reactive and caught by it and just see it clearly for what it is. That's one way to get very deeply peaceful in meditation. Is this making sense? So in the last meditation we did, I asked you at the end to let go of the breath and tune into your emotional state, your mood, your mental state. Were any of you able to do that? And if so, what happened when you brought your attention to that part of your experience? Yes?
I noticed I was feeling anxious, and as I focused on that, it did diminish.
It diminished,
not
yeah.
Not completely, but less intensity.
Uh-huh. There's sometimes it won't. Sometimes anxiety will get stronger. There's three things that might happen to emotions when you pay attention to it. They'll get weaker, they'll go away, they'll get stronger, or they'll stay the same. And as meditators, we don't care. We just want to be mindful of how it is. But a lot of emotions will often dissipate. Unhealthy, kind of so-called negative emotions, will dissipate as we bring attention to them, because they tend to be fed by unawareness. There's all this kind of anxiety and thoughts and stories and worries that are going on. They're feeding it, but they're kind of like half out of awareness. We're not really fully acknowledging it. But if you fully acknowledge it, is a way in which we release that unconscious feeding of it, subconscious feeding of it, and it tends to dissipate much quickly by itself. That's probably what you experienced. Yeah?
I had a lot of different emotions going on.
Kaleidoscope?
Yeah.
Great.
So when I was trying to label it, I'm like, well, frustration, anger, you know, all this stuff, so I don't know. That's, you know, there was just a lot.
Going on. That's great. So then your label is lots.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, so lots, and or just, you know, kaleidoscope, or just the biggest umbrella kind of label acknowledgement of what's happening is something like, you know, chaos or, you know, confusion. And then people it's so chaotic and confusing what's going on sometimes. And people are trying to look through that and see, well, I'm supposed to kind of be with my breath. I'm supposed to be with some particular way to feel it in my body or something. And what's happening is just chaos. So you have to just accept that and become the world-class connoisseur of what chaos feels like. Just, okay, I'm supposed to accept chaos, and this is what chaos feels like. And as you do that, when you accept it that way, you know, the biggest possible container that holds it in awareness, then soon enough you'll probably begin discerning some of the details of it. Oh, chaos. Chaos is mostly feeling of a lot of energetic feelings. Not my little toe. It seems like it's mostly in the area between, you know, my hips and my head. And suddenly you've kind of made it a little bit more focused and you notice something more precise about it. And then you found it was mostly, you know, anyway. But you start with the biggest container and not try to kind of scratch your way into some precision which isn't available at the moment. So
you know, the other thing that goes on for me is, it's, you know, I just started doing this and it's not very comfortable to sit like that.
Uh-huh.
And so I have a lot of like physical things going on in the bottom, like my feet are falling asleep, and so it was hard to do the emotion part because I felt so many physical things.
Uh-huh. So there's two things you can do with that. If there's a lot of physical discomfort, you could sit in a chair, which probably would make a difference. And that way maybe you wouldn't have, what?
I sat in the chair.
And?
Well,
chair's not so good.
Not so good.
Yeah.
And so then you're stuck, I suppose. And so just, you know. And for a lot of beginners, part of the process of entering into the spiritual world or this inner world of meditation is to learn how to relate to physical discomfort in a wise way and go through the process of the body adapting and having the patience to go through it. Patience is one of the really important spiritual qualities that people first need to learn. And, you know, unfortunately, the people who need to learn it are the people who don't have it. So it's kind of difficult, you know. It's kind of difficult. But if you feel inspired enough with the meditation practice to hang in there long enough to see through the period of time where the body is being difficult, then I just encourage you to just go through it and accept that's the condition, and you'll do a lot of mindfulness of the body, developing mindfulness of the body and all that, and being aware of those sensations. If it becomes grueling so that you don't even want to go back and meditate, you just don't have the inspiration, it's just like, why bother? Then you might want to find some other way of sitting so that you don't have, you know, so you're not giving it up because of the difficulty. And maybe some other chair, or maybe There's you know, that knee chair there. Some people find a lot very helpful, or a bench, or maybe, you know, we can talk at the end of one of these classes, and I can try to engineer you know, some kind of way for you to sit that can work. Someone else? Your experience in that sitting? About the emotions when I asked you?
What I noticed was just that I was catching almost immediately when my brain was getting in that sort of pre-sleep state. I was noticing, I mean, this wasn't so much feelings, but I was noticing the moment when my thoughts were becoming tangled and that I was inserting sort of nonsense stuff into my thoughts, which is sort of a precursor to when you drift off. I was catching that.
Great.
Sooner.
Did that help you wake up and
yeah.
stay awake? Yeah. Great. Yes?
Why is it that being in a more of a reclined position wouldn't work?
There's no essential right posture for meditation. However, there are pragmatic postures, pragmatically reclining tends to put people asleep. People tend not to be so alert. Some people who have, for example, health problems like back problems can only do meditation lying down. And that's fine. There are people sometimes who sit with us who lay down. But we don't, unless there's a real need for it, we don't encourage it because it's a little bit harder to stay alert and awake. Though I know people who've had very successful meditation careers doing all their meditation lying down. I've also known people who've had to do all their meditation standing, which is very challenging. But they've had a very, 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 done it very well standing. But pragmatically, if you can sit upright and have your spine self-supporting, pragmatically it tends to be the best situation. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about either, and I'm not sure if it's an absence of emotion or a lack of sensitivity? So I can focus on the breath. You know, that's pretty mechanical. Rainy day, sunny day, I can do that. Physical pain, sometimes I don't feel any. So there's just nothing there. So maybe it's not strong enough for me to feel.
Great.
I'm not that sensitive.
Yeah.
Emotions, same thing.
So
it seems sort of strange to me that you said, what emotions you feel? I think I didn't feel
anything. Along with what he said.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for an emotion. I'm looking for it. I'm right there with it. Breath. Neutral.
So that's I understand that. Every state, every moment of consciousness, there's some kind of mental state or emotional state that's present. But sometimes it's so subtle we don't identify it. We're not used to paying attention to it or something. There was one woman who came on a retreat once, and she came to interview, and she said, I'm having some strange, you know, state or emotional state or something I never had. So I don't know what it is. I can't describe it to you and identify it. But a teacher said, oh, we should just pay attention more carefully. And she came back the next time, 2 days later, and said, oh, I know what it is now. It's calm. I've never been calm in my life. I don't know. I didn't know what it was. So it can be very subtle. Or unfamiliar in some way. But the point in meditation is that we stay with the breath until an emotion becomes compelling enough that it's obvious this is what needs attention. You don't have to go looking for an emotion. Just when it comes knocking, then you pay attention to it. What? I mean, never, ever? Not today. Yeah, that's okay. Sometimes it doesn't have, you know, emotions don't come to the foreground at all. And that's fine. Well, neutral is, you're probably not feeling neutral. How is neutral experienced? Can you close your eyes? Can you go back and be with that neutral state? What? Nothing said? Are you relatively calm? At ease? Things get subtle, so anyway, it's fine. You don't have to feel an emotion now, but sooner or later you probably will. Are you an emotional person sometimes? Well, usually, yes. I wouldn't worry about it. So you don't have to believe me when I say that. You know, it's always some emotion there, some mental state, some mood. I don't care if you believe me or not. But it's not that important at this point. The important point here for the practice is stay with your breath the best you can. When an emotion becomes compelling enough that it becomes difficult not to stay with the breath, or it seems appropriate to let go of the breath and attend to the emotion, then pay attention to the emotion in this way that we're talking about today. And if you don't have an emotion ever in meditation, then if you never have one ever, then you should come and talk to a teacher, and we'll explore what's going on. Now, some people in our society, men more often than women, but sometimes certainly women can do it, will shut off from their emotions. Sometimes they've had a trauma in life, and they don't want to kind of really face the trauma or those memories or whatever. And so they shut off that capacity to feel that would somehow tie them into that trauma or that event. Or they have some certain religious background which teaches them that certain things are unacceptable. So they shut down parts of their body. They don't pay attention to it. And there are people who shut down from their waist down, people who shut down from the neck down. Often shutting down emotions, not paying attention to emotion, because the emotions are so strongly related to what happens in the body, to shut down an emotional our capacity to feel certain emotions usually comes with shutting down feel certain parts of our body, aspects of our body. Some people, so it's a kind of repressed quality that some people have, or shut down quality. Generally, as people do the practice itself tends to free that up and open that up in its own good time. You don't have to be in a hurry and try to break it open. Just let the practice, trust the practice, and things will unfold in its own way. Sometimes people have never really paid much attention to their emotions because they're always so busy. They've always engaged in projects. Sometimes people who are very much involved in computers, I've noticed, they're always in this project mode, and never occurred to them to notice anything else, and so they're kind of emotionally literates. And they don't have the vocabulary even for how to identify their emotions and recognize it. There's a book called Emotional Literacy, or Emotional Intelligence, right? But to become emotionally literate is something, it's not so, it doesn't automatically come with being a human being. It's a learned, acquired skill that some people learn through growing up or whatever, and some people don't. So sometimes people need to learn a little bit of emotional vocabulary and emotional literacy in order to be able to identify what's going on emotionally with them. Otherwise, it's just kind of all a blur. So generally in the meditation practice itself, the practice always starts or always relates to what we're actually experiencing. So if we're not really feeling an emotion, we don't worry about it. And we don't have to make a big deal out of it. Some people in California have these manifestos about their emotions and are really into them in a big way, and everything is about their emotions, and it's a little bit overdone sometimes, and emotions sometimes are overvalued by some people. And some people undervalue them, as I talked about. And, in Buddhism, we're not trying to, we're not trying to celebrate our emotional life. But we're certainly not trying to repress it. We're just trying to be kind of very honest and open and matter-of-fact and unrepressed, letting it flow as it is. And some people need to kind of learn how not to be so identified with their emotions in order to become freer. And some people need to learn how to tune into that part much more actively and develops emotional literacy. So if a person's sitting in meditation for a long time, regular practice, and never really aware of any emotion at all, then probably they should come and talk to a teacher, and we'll explore that a little bit and see what's going on, and see if we can help a little bit.
Can you talk about the difference between emotions and feelings?
I think what Allison's referring to is that that in Buddhist technical language of human experience, emotions, feelings, does not refer to emotions, but feeling refers to the feeling tone of any experience. So any experience we have is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Actually, the technical word is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And it's said that the neutral is phenomenally rare. So all experience have some quality of being either pleasant or unpleasant. And what's very interesting is a lot of our reactivity is based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, like amoeba-like reactivity to what's going on. And we build whole political philosophies, you know, to justify it. But it's initially just kind of just recoiling from the unpleasant or trying to grab hold of the pleasant. And so, and sometimes our emotional life is has to do with that reactivity to the pleasant and the unpleasant. And it can be very freeing to see how that actually operates, that very simple, fundamental level of going towards and away from things. And emotions have to do with the... it's much more complicated. What we, in English, usually think of as feelings and emotions, you know, anger and fear and joy and all those things. Is that kind of what you had in mind? Yes?
I just think, instead of trying to name and label things, if I just watch my breath and the weight of the breath, you know, it's like it gets tense and heavy when... It's either emotion or feeling, what I mean, to not worry, yeah. Something about it. And it definitely gets lighter, freer, smoother when it's just there. And I kind of feel the naming and the feeling, for me, is distracting.
It can be. So the technique of naming or mental noting, which is often part of Vipassana, is not an essential part of Vipassana practice. And there are a lot of Vipassana mindfulness meditators who don't use it at all, partly for the reason you say, partly they feel it's agitating and all that. It's kind of making yourself more busy rather than more peaceful. But if a person is not familiar with the mental noting, we're actually naming or noting the experience as it arises, the breath, the physical sensations, the emotions, you might want to try it for a while, because it's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. At first, learning to ride a bicycle is kind of agitating. You know, you don't feel kind of tense, and it's kind of, it doesn't go very well. It's smoother to walk, but you hang in there, and after a while, it becomes second nature, and you can let go of the handlebars and look. You know, just kind of go along smoothly. The same thing with the mental noting. At first, it can feel awkward in the mind, but it's a skill that gets learned, and after a while, it becomes smoother and easier, and it can be very helpful for some people. And what we found is on like meditation retreats, long retreats, and this is a dangerous thing to say, but those people who use the mental noting as an adjunct to the mindfulness tend, as a generalization, tend to make faster progress in the practice than those people who don't.
And where does feeling fall in that?
Sorry?
But where does feeling fall in that equation? Is feeling, do people move away, I mean, progress more if they name the feeling as opposed to name the
I think when I, this is just you name people who note everything that arises. So part of the technique, one of the techniques of mindfulness, is just very peacefully, calmly, note whatever you're paying attention to in the moment. And so if it's an emotion, you'd note that emotion.
Both activate the mind, though, and that's my problem.
Yes. Noting can activate the mind. If someone is familiar with another meditation practice from before, it can seem very agitating, very busy to use the noting. But if you're honest, most people, the aspect of the mind that's doing the noting is a very, very quiet whisper in the back of the mind. It's very rudimentary functioning of the mind. And you can actually get very, very still and concentrated while you're still doing this very simple noting. What some people do, there's a whole art to the noting thing. And I don't know if there's a talk of mine. I did some talk some time ago that on mental noting. But the some people only use the noting technique early in their meditation, and as the mind gets more and more concentrated and still, then they'll stop using it because it's no longer needed. Some people only use it to name certain things, the kind of things they get most likely get caught by. Like they only note thoughts, label thinking. The other things they're aware of, but they don't label it. But thinking they label because that's where they tend to get caught, and it helps them to kind of be a little disentangled. So there's a whole art to this technique of mental noting. I think for now, and I think just for this kind of introductory course purposes, I'd encourage you to, in a very simple, easygoing way, when something arises that you're paying attention to, whether it's the breath or the body sensations or the emotions, in a very simple, innocent kind of way, just name it very quietly and just leave it at that. Name it maybe two or three times and just to see what happens when you do that, see if that makes a difference. So, I hope this hasn't been too complicated. If any time the instructions seem complicated, you're welcome to go back to the earlier instructions. Just go back to the breath. The mindfulness practice is supposed to be really simple. So if you think it's complicated, relax. So I hope that in the next week, as you do the practice and sit, that as the emotions arise, you begin to learn a different way of being with your emotions. It might be different than how you've already done it, how you already do it. Learn how to have that independence, that freedom, that acceptance, that openness, with very clear, that clear awareness of what's happening of the emotions that allows you to have that independent meditative awareness in the midst of the emotion also. Not being for them, against them, so that the emotions themselves become further, in a sense, food for the meditative process, just as the breath is. You find that inner stillness or concentration or ease or peace or whatever, with whatever arises. I hope this all makes sense, and if it doesn't make sense, it'd be lovely to hear about that. And I'll stay behind a little bit if you have questions. And I apologize that we didn't get a chance to do a little second sitting. I like to have two sittings for these intro classes, so I'm not just talking all the time. But so it is. We accept the actual. Thank you.